All right, The Empire Strikes Back. That's what you titled this week's timestamp.
I was waiting for you to do the whole thing. I was just going to sit here and enjoy it. Whole rendition. Yeah, Empire Strikes Back. You know, I think this week, this month, this year, this Trump 2.0 has just been trending firmly in one direction. And we've called it out more and more over the last, you know, handful of months doing the show. You've called it out on TFTC. We've talked about it in the timestamp. But, you know, imperial is like the word that kind of comes to mind increasingly with what we're seeing. And they're not to apply any value judgments one way or the other to that. I think we can agree that that is not our ideal direction of travel for this country. But as objective analysts of what's going on, increasingly it looks more and more that way. I think there's a question of, you know, a lot of us have, if you're interested in Bitcoin, if you're interested in financial markets, generally world history, you look at the US and you say, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, we've displayed a lot of trademarks of a declining great power. And certainly I think our commander in chief has given us many of those of his own over the last year or so, especially with his tweets. But, you know, I think it's worth asking, you know, if we map ourselves to Rome, as many people often do, are we entering the decline of the Republic stage or the decline of the Empire stage? Because those are very different phases of the history of that great power and of a lot of great powers that follow similar cycles. And, you know, a lot of people are ready to stick a fork in the U.S., but they maybe should be sticking a fork in the U.S. Republic, not the U.S. Empire. So, yeah, that's kind of the theme of this week.
Yeah. And it's, we were talking before I hit record, but I was in New York Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at the OpNext conference and events around it, and was happy to have a few days where I wasn't bombarded by the headlines. I mean, they were happening behind the scenes, but I was busy. I felt like it was going to be busy. Last week, over the weekend, went to a Monster Jam, 4-year-old birthday party, Monster Jam, low-key, one of the best parts of Americana, very Americana, and then had a family dinner yesterday. So I've been relatively unplugged for the last 5 days. And from what I can tell, one thing we've been trying to do, and maybe we'll play a quick game here, is just actually not look at the headlines because they just ping pong your emotions and just focus on the data. And the data, particularly if you look at WTI, is showing that oil prices are down. It looks like ceasefire on, ceasefire off, ceasefire on, maybe. Gas prices, WTI oil prices, excuse me, would signal that maybe this is at least de-escalating to a point of relative calm that will allow markets to function again, sitting at $86 per barrel right now.
Yeah. Look, you know, your instinct is right. I think everyone should be off the screens, frankly, as much as they can. It's increasingly low return on time and increasingly a DOS attack on your attention to really follow the headlines closely. I think the first slide in that chart pack for this week illustrates it nicely, that in only the last week, you know, every week feels like a year. In only the last week, we've gone from ceasefire to Vance is going out to Pakistan for negotiations to actually there was no deal. Now we're going to blockade you. And actually now talks are going well. Iran's going to give up uranium, no nuclear program, straits open. It's all great. Market rips to literally all-time highs, fully erasing all the drawdown from start of the war. So actually over the weekend, well, you know, on second thought, it's closed again and talks are not going well suddenly. So it's Michael Scott, snip, snap, snip, snap, basically every day of the week. And so I think this is just a great illustration of how little the average market participant knows or can really rely on anything that they're seeing come across their Bloomberg or CNBC on any given day.
Yeah. And again, looking at pricing signals in the market, that was another thing. Bitcoin screamed up to 78,000 on the 17th. So last Friday, and it's held up pretty well throughout all this. I know you mentioned markets at all-time highs. Haven't even looked at where they are today, but it looks like markets opened down today slightly, flat to down. But Bitcoin's been holding strong throughout all this. And I sent a tweet out when I hit send. I was like, maybe this is too early. There's only a month of data here, but you had Bitcoin on the 1 month chart really diverging from the software stocks index from Vanguard. I think, what is it, IVG? There was some sharp divergence there. Bitcoin up 6%. Software stocks down about 1%, and they've been trading in tandem since the middle of last year.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, like it, this is not a data-driven viewpoint, but as you look at everything, it feels like the market wants to go up, right? Bitcoin, certainly stocks, you know, back to all-time highs. It definitely, treasuries have, yields have retrenched to maybe a somewhat more manageable level. Treasury volatility is down. VIX is down. On any semi-positive news, we rip. And on any, you know, meaningfully negative news, like this morning, we're kind of just flat, right? So the positioning is such that for various different reasons, it definitely looks like market wants to go up, which is a problem. And that may reverse, but it's a problem for the taco trade, right? Or at least if your view is Trump has the chicken out, he's sensitive about stock market, he's sensitive about treasury yields, all these different things. Well, maybe that may be true, but if that's the case, and that's his primary Achilles heel and primary constraint, even after he sent 10 destroyers, 12 destroyers, whatever, into the Persian Gulf to turn away dozens of ships and kind of imperially take control thus far of that area, and stocks are all-time highs, I mean, that says something about where the cards are sitting right now, right? So if your entire bet, if your entire philosophy, if your entire worldview is it's just a matter of time before the US has to pull back because Trump's so worried about the stock market, well, you know, he's got a lot of leeway right now. And you could say it's because of market manipulation. You know what? Yeah, probably. Like, probably. But like, that's the game you get to play when you're the currency hegemon, when you're for now, the largest military power in the world. So yeah, I think just a lot of narratives being challenged this week, all over the place, for better and worse.
Yeah, and one that we've been, it's a sub narrative that we've been following for many months now, is this sort of, maybe not a proxy war, but a meta war of the US versus China, and the effect that everything going on in the Middle East has on the relative leverage between the two superpowers. And you touched on that as well, again, highlighting the fact that it seems like Trump is willing to stomach elevated gas prices at the pump because I would imagine the calculus that's being run at the administration level is that the damage being done to China's economy far exceeds the damage to the American consumer.
Yeah. To quote Rod Bramlett, the late great announcer for Auburn sports, not an Auburn fan, but big fan of Rod Bramlett for his kick six call. Here's your ball game, right? Like, I think this is kind of what it ultimately comes down to. Like, who blinks first on these metrics? Like, can Trump and the Republicans manage midterms with somewhat elevated gas prices in such a way that they can grin and bear it relative to the eastern side of the world that is much more directly impacted by flows out of the Strait? Very much TBD. Like, I don't know. And, you know, if this situation plus various other domestic issues collectively cause the Republicans to lose significant ground in Congress at the midterms and things get deadlocked and Trump becomes a lame duck, like, that changes the calculus of a lot of things. So it's not like he's, you know, without constraints here, or it's not like the U.S. faction, the U.S. imperial faction broadly is without constraints. But I think this is really like this is the game, right? And this is what we'll have to be watching over the next 6 months more than anything.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think there's a lot of games within the game, and the game in which we alluded to at the front end of the show, and which we'll probably talk about a lot moving forward. And I want to give you props because you've been banging this drum for the better part of a year now, I believe, since the Intel chip deal was made, or the investment in Intel by the federal government was made last year. But this imperial nationalization, industrialization in the U.S. and very heavy sort of trade deals with countries that are in our hemisphere.
Yeah. I mean, and this, you know, this is really like, I think the crux of like the imperial threat of this week is just how many of these things came across the wire, you know, this week, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not. But you've got, you know, this Indonesia partnership, which TBD what it ultimately will mean, but Indonesia is relevant if you haven't been kind of paying attention to the map for its influence over the Strait of Malacca, which is broadly considered the most trafficked strait in the world. So we've been talking about Strait of Hormuz for, you know, months on end now, but, you know, Malacca is very important to the eastern part of the world, especially China. So interesting timing for a partnership here. These various other deals, we don't have to go through each one, but you can just see the administration getting, you know, more and more heavy-handed and explicit in all of these little leverage points as it relates to either kind of our relationship to China or our relationship to kind of Chinese proxies. You know, this Brazilian presidential election polymarket now has Bolsonaro, the former president, who is very MAGA aligned and Trump friendly, who I think was polling on polymarket like 3 months ago at like sub 1%, is now either tied or like either ahead or tied with the incumbent Lula, who's very aligned. And, you know, maybe that's a CIA, maybe it's not, maybe it's totally grassroots organic, who knows. But this past week has definitely seen a lot of examples of U.S. flexing its muscle in different spots and consolidating leverage around the world. And again, I think there's a big game being played here, and this is, you know, this is a Bitcoin show. We'll get to Bitcoin. We talk about Bitcoin. That's our primary lens for everything. But, you know, there's clearly like a great power competition going on here. And the events that we're seeing are not random. They're not just Trump being insane, lashing out. That may be part of it. He may be leveraging that insanity. I don't know. But there is a broader kind of deep state competition meta narrative here between two factions of the world.
Well, I picked up on it over the weekend because the TFTC account covered it, but Mark Carney's comments, I guess, in reaction to Trump's posturing towards Canada specifically, and if you're thinking like deep state actors placing Mark Carney in the prime minister role of Canada, seems to be very strategic for the incumbent power structure. If you know the history of Mark Carney at the Bank of England, at HSBC, and his involvement in the cartel money laundering case with HSBC, where they're putting briefcases full of cash through teller windows. They designed a teller window. He's had his fingers in everything. Many would consider him a Davos class economic actor. And it seems like I'll put my tinfoil hat on and I'll just say it. I won't speak for you, but I think he was placed in Canada for a reason. And it seems like he's trying to enter the narrative battle and say that the relationship with the United States is not what it used to be and won't be as beneficial moving forward if the powers that be in the United States remain as the powers that be. So I think that was very interesting over the weekend to see as well. It will be fascinating to see if Mark Carney in Canada, which is a fledgling economy to the north of us, has any leverage here.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear Tom Luongo somewhere in rural Florida yelling about the City of London. So yes, I agree with that. And it seems like our Commerce Secretary on the top right here, Howard Lutnick, also agrees that the relationship is going to require some serious restructuring. So which is something we've been writing about for a few months as well, with the USMCA agreement between U.S., Mexico, and Canada coming up for renewal in summer. So yeah, all of a piece with the great game that I think we're seeing play out here.
Yeah, great game continues. We'll get to Bitcoin, but rare earth metals at the center, or part of the center of this great game, especially considering the AI race that we're in, these rare earth metals that are necessary to build the compute infrastructure that will bring us AGI, is something that many countries have been making a land grab for over the last 18 months. And there was a deal this morning. U.S. Rare Earth announces definitive agreement to acquire Serra Verde Group for $2.8 billion, creating the global rare earth leader.
Yeah, this wasn't in the issue this past weekend, but it hit this morning. I thought it's exactly aligned with everything we've just talked about and stuff we talked about in over the past few months as well. I think the headline kind of speaks for itself. We know rare earths are important. We know the U.S. is behind in rare earth refining capacity relative to China, which has thus far a relative chokehold over the whole world. And we saw that how that could play out last fall when they announced some major export restrictions. So it's clearly been a priority of the U.S. and the Trump administration to ameliorate that and address that. And I think the most interesting piece of this is related to industrial policy, which we've talked about on the show before. You mentioned me kind of starting to talk about that more with the Intel deal. I think the thing that really first just like tipped me off to it was last summer with the MP Materials deal for an equity, massive equity stake in MP Materials, another rare earth producer in the U.S., with offtake agreements as well and price floors, which is very industrial policy, very World War II preparation style, unfortunately kind of central planning flavored policy. Well, you're seeing that here as well with this deal. And so a major financing package for the deal from the Development Finance Corporation, which is government Pentagon aligned, as well as a long-term 15-year 100% offtake agreement with price floors, largely it looks like subsidized authorized by and guaranteed by the government. So yeah, just even an even more explicit, I think, version of what we saw before, the US kind of flexing its financial might and its ability to subsidize deals like this to go out even into other countries and, you know, go acquire strategic assets for that'll be, you know, key leverage points for AI and for advanced, you know, military applications as well. So, you know, you got to be careful because you can fall into what's it called? It's like Bader-Meinhof complex, where like you kind of adopt a lens for something or you think about something and then you just start to see it more and more everywhere. So you don't want to like fall into the trap that like just because you're seeing a lot of data points stack up that favor a certain thesis, like that necessarily means that like, you know, you could be falling into confirmation bias, right? So got to be careful about that. But, you know, it certainly seems in the last few months, just like every single week, it's like more and more headlines like this, the snowball is rolling faster and faster on this theme. And, you know, personally, I'm in a place where I don't really expect that to slow down anytime soon.
Yeah, because we did a deal like this in Brazil not too long ago, right? Because I remember there were headlines about a European sort of coalition going down to Brazil to discuss a deal for rare earths with that country. And they got there and they said, well, the US just came and locked it up for the next 5 years. And
yeah, this that was a few weeks back. The
terms on this deal, 15-year, 100% offtake, is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And again, like that's the kind of game you can play when you for now have the dollar infrastructure, right? When you have that stick, may not have it forever, right? Many empires in the past have ultimately lost control of it. But that's the situation that we are at least, you know, currently in. And the US looks very willing to flex all that right now.
Which gets to the next topic that we have to discuss, which is the de-dollarization narrative, which has been a big one. Hand up. I've highlighted it many times over the last year and throughout the years, but it seems like the de-dollarization narrative is being challenged in real time as well.
Yeah. Look, like it's not, I think it's a reasonable and defensible narrative on a long enough time frame for a variety of reasons that we can go into and that you've discussed extensively on TFTC. But I think the path to get there is a lot more jagged than people often think. And thus far, you know, this week, I think we saw two really interesting data points where in a time when we're hearing about, you know, the petro yuan and the fracturing global order, moving people, moving countries and sovereigns, you know, away from the dollar and more into, say, China's orbit or like a, you know, a BRICS currency orbit or some other competing power. You know, you saw Norway, the head of Norway's sovereign wealth fund, saying despite all the volatility, despite disruptions in the Gulf, despite the, you know, U.S. deficits blowing out and, you know, Trump tweeting pictures of himself as Jesus Christ, they have no plans currently to reduce holdings of U.S. assets. And in the midst of all this turmoil, several Gulf states also launched a fairly large collective offering of dollar-backed or dollar-denominated bonds to shore up finances, you know, as they wait for the storm to pass with oil revenues. And so I think it just shows you like the U.S. is still does have cards to play on the financial front. There is still a significant network effect built up around the dollar and the dollar system. We've seen thus far in this conflict, countries do respond still to heavy-handed sanctions activity, for better or worse. And so I think it's worth asking, like, and I tried to do this in the timestamp this week, like if the US is going imperial and kind of moving in that direction, and it has cards to play with a coalition of, you know, let's say the GCC, Japan, South Korea, a few other East Asian states, if it can also gain some influence in various South American states, you know, we've seen that in Argentina already, right, with the Malay relationship. Maybe increasingly moving in that direction with Brazil, Venezuela, various other regions that Trump has expressed interest in. If we can gain, you know, maritime control over Strait of Hormuz, potentially over Strait of Malacca, Greenland, right, on the Northern Sea routes, like that starts to potentially stack up into a world where maybe you kick the can down the road on de-dollarization. Maybe you have enough captive buyers of U.S. dollar-linked assets, treasuries, equities, et cetera, to kind of keep the system spinning and running for who knows how long. But I think you could believe that and still be incredibly bullish on Bitcoin and neutral reserve assets, right? Because I think the world where that happens is the world where necessarily there's a lot more headroom for dollar claims issuance, right, at both the public and private level. And if we've learned anything about U.S. history over the last 100 years, it's that headroom gets used, like it will get used aggressively. And I think that has a one-way function for the scarcest asset in human history, particularly in a world where, you know, whether the dollar network gets locked in more or not, I think people have gotten the message that countries have gotten the message that sovereign sacks across every metric are very incredibly important, strategically important. And so I think that message will flow to understanding of Bitcoin as well over time. So yeah, I think ask yourself, like, does de-dollarization need to happen? Does the petro yuan need to happen? Do we need to enter into 1000% hyperinflation or a massive, unprecedented big print? All of which is possible. But do we need that for Bitcoin to be an attractive investment, for Bitcoin to be an attractive technology to use for payments at the sovereign level, the institutional level? And I think the answer is definitively no.
Agreed. Another important country in our hemisphere that are getting more control over Panama as well, like owning the Panama Canal,
right,
is a big part. That was probably the first domino to fall. And to your point, I think another way to say what you just eloquently expressed, to distill it, is in a left side of the bell curve sort of phrase, is a melt up maybe on the table. And you're going to win hard assets if a melt up's on the table. I'm becoming more convinced of that. Actually going to record with Capital Flows later this afternoon to talk about his thesis of a melt up on the table. So be on the lookout for that. But now we can get to Bitcoin, talking about what, if any, effects this has on Bitcoin. I think, like you said, without de-dollarization, Bitcoin is well positioned to succeed in a world, particularly in a hyper-digitalized world with an agentic economy emerging. But the other thing, Stretch, so hot right now. I hope you're stretching your legs, because Michael Saylor and the team over at Strategy are putting together a pretty memetically powerful preferred stock option with a dividend. And Stretch really took over the headlines and took a lot of the mental space, the mental bandwidth of the industry last week.
Yeah, as MSTR linked things are wont to do, became the main character once again. And here you see, just really quick, like the a lot of green flags going up, a lot of checkered flags going up and being waved in the institutional space for Bitcoin adoption. I'll say adoption air quotes, because a lot of these, it's arguable how much this represents true sovereign Bitcoin adoption. But regardless, a lot of conduits being opened up for capital to flow through more traditional routes into Bitcoin, which is an interesting thing to see, again, with a lot of analysts calling for World War III and the end of the U.S. and these massive unprecedented changes that suddenly institutions would want to provide massive access to Bitcoin. So, more data points on that front. And yeah, here you've got the Stretch chart pulled from strc.live, coming up on, looks like 100,000 Bitcoin acquired through the Stretch vehicle. Strategy announced this morning that they're now close to 820,000 Bitcoin held. And again, Stretch has been a big piece of accelerating that. It probably merits its own episode. 1031 partner Matt O'Dell and I spent a good part of Friday morning blowing up the team chat, having a friendly debate over whether Stretch would ultimately lead to a massive crash in the entire Bitcoin ecosystem. I'll say I'm directionally more bullish than Matt, with some ongoing reservations, primarily related to all of the DeFi dad.eth. Yeah, all of the second derivatives being built on top of Stretch. Certainly, maybe some questionable fundamentals there long term. But we felt like we had to put this chart on here and have to acknowledge that it's happening. I think, again, we're coming up on time here, so we don't have to litigate it all, but maybe we'll spend a little more time on it next week, thinking through the mechanics and sustainability or lack thereof from Stretch.
Well, the one comment I'll add, that's the thing that scared me. It's like because I think a lot of the volume that we saw last week was driven by these DeFi protocols spinning up to take advantage of the 11% yield and the memetic power of Stretch. We've seen publicly traded entities offering their own preferred products that are using Stretch as a treasury asset. And particularly on the DeFi side, the protocol side, I'm sure you've been following it. So one of the few things I've been following over the weekend, because it's just so fascinating and validates something that we've been warning about in the space for many years, is the draining of multiple DeFi protocols by hackers, because the virtual machines that they're running on aren't as secure as many people were led to believe, and are not as decentralized as many people were led to believe either. So that, like, if you have a bunch of DeFi actors going aping in the Stretch and they're doing it on insecure protocols or using insecure smart contracts, could get interesting there as well.
If only there had been signs, if only there had been 5,000 such incidents before this, maybe we would have learned, but
we wanted to wrap it up. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, I attended the OpNext conference in New York City last week. Shout out to everybody at Blockspace Media, Will, Charlie, Colin and team. It was an incredible event. And as one can imagine, one of the more pressing topics, really the dominant topic of the week was quantum. There were a ton of individuals on both sides of the argument of Bitcoin's preparedness and whether or not it should be prepared by 2029. We're in attendance at the conference, and this tweet that we have up here is from me. I'm quote tweeting Alex B, who was in the room as well, but there was an institutional investor panel that included BlackRock, Coinbase, Anchorage Digital, and one other institutional investment firm whose name is escaping me right now, but they were talking about their perspectives on quantum. And I thought it was quite interesting and, for lack of a better term, a bit tone deaf, and maybe not tone deaf, but very naive. It seems like Coinbase, BlackRock, and others are saying our investors are very worried about the quantum risk in Bitcoin to the point that it's keeping them off the sidelines, and we need to do something about this. And even though this is in quotes, this was a paraphrase. I tried to get as much verbatim as I could, but I was typing on the go as the panel was going on. But I think the tenor at the end of the panel was that these institutions were going to ensure, I mean, again, paraphrase, but the gist was they're going to ensure that Bitcoin is upgraded and quantum resistant by 2029, aligning with the sort of NIST protocol upgrades and what Cloudflare and Google have announced in terms of their moves to quantum resistant address structures, or excuse me, cryptographic structures, cryptographic algorithms by 2029. And I think for those of us who've been in the industry for a while and were in that room, it was very reminiscent of the New York agreement in 2016 that led to the fork war, where you had a bunch of larger institutions get together and say that they were going to push for a change to, back then, the block size of Bitcoin blocks. And this time around, we're going to make sure that we upgrade in a timely manner to prepare for quantum. So making sure that a post-quantum cryptographic signature scheme is live by 2029. So it was very interesting. I think my take is that there's a lot of, I think the institution should eat some humble pie and understand the ramifications of trying to push something like that. And the other thing I'll say is that leaning on the authority of NIST, or the perceived authority of NIST. Everybody's pointing at NIST and saying, well, NIST is saying that, and NIST is doing this, and we need to do what NIST is saying. I think it's, again, tone deaf and naive, because Bitcoin, Satoshi picked Libsec P256K1, that cryptographic library, because he looked at a lot of the NIST approved and recommended cryptographic signature schemes, and found that a lot of them had embedded constants, which ultimately led to backdoors. And so this whole appeal to authority with NIST specifically, I think, is dangerous, and something that people shouldn't look at NIST and say, oh, well, whatever they say, we should do. Satoshi actually looked at what they were doing and did something else, because their cryptographic library scheme, some of them at least, had backdoors.
Yeah. Look, I wasn't in the room. I wish I'd been able to go. It seems like a great high signal conference. And this is obviously something we've been talking about a lot for the last few months. We'll probably continue to have occasion to talk about it. You know, I continue to think there are times in your life when action bias is a positive, and a lot of times in your life when action bias, you should fade action bias. And I think this is certainly one of the times when it's the latter. And the last thing I'll maybe say, just to frame things up, how I think about this conversation at a very high level. A lot more could be said, but in, you know, public company investing, and Bitcoin's not a public company, but in public company investing, one of the key hallmarks of a CEO and a management team you want to avoid is when they're overly focused on short-term gyrations in stock price. Like, they just got to get the stock price up, and they're really freaked out when the stock price goes down one quarter, when the market misunderstands a quarter and sells the stock on earnings or something. And they're just hyper-focused on, you know, not long-term 5-10 year shareholder value, but like, did the stock price go up today? And I see a lot of that in the conversation about quantum, both from the institutional side, but also from some technical people as well. And it is absolutely important for Bitcoin to accrue economic mass over time. But anyone making a decision because on a basis of not wanting the price to go down on some perceived or feared sell-off event related to, you know, some hypothetical scenario where a quantum attacker steals Satoshi's coins and dumps them all in the market immediately and causes some huge drawdown, I would just encourage people to fade that type of thinking, because that is a great way to optimize for decisions that will not help and will not drive value and will not drive stability and sustainability in the long term for any system, right? For a company or for Bitcoin. So yeah, that's just something I throw out there. You don't have to co-sign that, but generally that's proven to be a good heuristic in my life and my investing as well.
No, I co-signed that. And that was another thing. I mean, we'll end it on this, but the BlackRock representative, the head of digital assets at BlackRock, forgot his name, but he's saying investors are not going to come in. The price will not go up unless we figure this out. And it'll be funny if we're sitting in September and the price is well north of where it is now, potentially, if it is at a new all-time high. Like, how does that argument change? So I just want to put a pin in that market. It was said on this date that the price would not go up because of the quantum risk. If the conversation around quantum has not progressed at all, but the price is well above where it was last week when that comment was made, I think we should hold these people to account and say, well, it doesn't seem like the market is really pricing this in as much of a risk as you were saying back then. So have you thought about maybe you're wrong and we should approach this in a different way? So just mark that, put a pin in that.
Marked, noted.
See you guys next week.